Commission. Please be seated.
Good morning. Welcome to the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals and to our Pasadena courthouse, the Richard Chambers Courthouse here in Pasadena. I wish we had better weather for you all. Sorry about that. This is the time set for our argument in Apache Stronghold versus United States of America. Before we proceed, I just want to check. Judge Gould is appearing by video. Judge Gould, can you hear me?
Yes, I can hear you.
Okay. Good morning. And so I believe we're ready to proceed. So if you'd like to begin, the lawyers for Apache Stronghold may begin.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, Luke Goodrich on behalf of Apache Stronghold. I'll be aiming to reserve about 6 minutes for rebuttal. To answer the substantial burden question in this case, it helps to start with a very important point on which both parties agree. Both parties agree that if the United States government put up no trespassing signs and threatened the Apaches with fines for accessing Oak Flat, that would be a substantial burden.
Can I ask a question about that, though? That goes more to the discrimination case, wouldn't it? If they said the Apaches, are you suggesting if they said the Apaches couldn't come on the property, but anybody else could? I mean, that would be a clear violation.
In our view, either way, a discriminatory ban or a discriminatory ban on access or a blanket ban on access would be a substantial burden. I haven't been able to get a clear answer from the government on that. But under RFRA, RFRA says you can't impose a substantial burden even if it results from a generally applicable law. So if a trespassing fine counts as a substantial burden under RFRA, RFRA instructs this court that it counts as a burden, whether it's a generally applicable rule or
not. Would it fit within the prior case law or the prior rule we adopted in Navajo Nation where you would be imposing a penalty for trying to exercise? So that seems different than what we're addressing here. I don't think it's dispositive of the case, but it's just an unusual hypothetical to come up with. Can I ask a question out of the gate? Where are we at on the FEIS? So as I understand it, the government withdrew that, and maybe I should ask them, but I assume you would know. They withdrew it in 2021. I don't think a new one had been adopted as of the opinion in 2022. Has the government come forward with a new FEIS?
No. 2 years ago, they said they would reinitiate consultation, and it would be a matter of months, but they still haven't published one.
Does that do anything to our ability to decide this case? Are you asking to enjoin the transfer, or are you asking to enjoin the building of the mine?
We're here on a preliminary injunction only, and we're asking to enjoin the transfer.
But is the transfer can't occur until the FEIS is completed?
It will occur. It must occur within 60 days after the FEIS is completed, and the government has represented that that will be republished in a matter of months.
Well, they represented that 2 years ago, too.
Yeah, my guess is they're just waiting for a decision in this case before they decide to move forward. So I started with the fines because that's where we all agree a fine is a substantial burden. But here the government is doing something far worse, not just threatening fines, but authorizing the complete physical destruction of Oak Flat, barring the Apaches from ever accessing it again, and ending their core religious exercises forever.
Counsel, how is that different from building the road in Ling versus Northwest?
Sure. The Supreme Court in Ling emphasized that the plaintiffs there continued to have access to every site where they engaged in religious practices and could engage in the same religious practices they engaged in before. The plaintiffs there complained that the road that was at least a half mile away would, quote, diminish the sacredness of the area. And the Supreme Court said that if there were a law that restricted the Native American respondents from visiting the site or accessing it, that would be a different case. So
they would have a different case. It was hypothetical, which they didn't answer.
True, but it drew a distinction between...
But I viewed that distinction, going back to your original hypothetical, as one on discrimination, not a different case. I mean, here's the problem. Under the First Amendment, you seem to have a pretty uphill battle because of the Ling case. It seems like your best argument is you've argued that RFRA expands and goes beyond the First Amendment. Is that an accurate recitation of your argument?
Court has said.
Because Ling, I don't understand. Ling, the Justice O'Connor and the majority specifically said, like, we're not going to get into these line drawing exercises under the First Amendment. So why should substantial burden be interpreted differently under RFRA than it is under the First Amendment?
Well, the Supreme Court has expressly held in Hobby Lobby that RFRA goes beyond what the First Amendment requires.
As to who can sue, not what can be sued upon.
But also the whole point of Smith, the First Amendment, Smith, says if the government is acting neutrally and generally applicable, with a generally applicable law, it doesn't matter how severe the burden is, you don't get to strict scrutiny. And that's precisely what Congress overturned by enacting RFRA and said it doesn't matter if the burden is imposed through a generally applicable law. If it's a substantial burden, you still impose strict scrutiny. And that goes beyond what the Supreme Court has interpreted the Free Exercise Clause.
Was Lake actually a substantial burden test? Did even Lake use the term substantial burden?
No, never used the term. But,
and Ling was in Employment Division versus Smith. Was essentially characterized as a case about neutrality.
Yes, Your
right?
Honor. Yes.
And it was rejected. Employment Division versus Smith specifically rejected the characterization of Ling as being about internal governmental affairs.
Correct.
So it was really a predecessor to Smith. It was really maybe the strongest case that Smith relied upon for its neutrality rule.
Yes.
And it was really about the neutrality principle.
Yes.
Is that right?
Yes,
so,
Your Honor.
So your attempt to distinguish it because of the nature of the intrusion is really beside the point, isn't it? In other words, the fact that it was a road rather than a complete destruction was really not what Ling was about. It did assume that it was a very severe restriction, but it isn't what the case was about.
Correct. I think there's two different grounds on which you can distinguish Ling. One is the legal ground you mentioned. Ling is a First Amendment case. It emphasized the First Amendment text of prohibit, and it emphasized multiple times that the burden was just incidental, meaning this is
a
neutral
action. And that's what
action.
Employment Division versus Smith said it was.
Yes, exactly. And that's what Trinity Lutheran said it was. That's what multiple cases have characterized it as. Look, back in under the First Amendment, we're distinguishing between neutral and generally applicable laws and laws
but
that are targeted.
What I mean is that's what Employment Division versus Smith said specifically about Ling,
yes.
Not just in general.
Yes, exactly. So that's a clear basis on which to distinguish Ling.
No, it's not a question of distinguish. I hate the word distinguish. I mean, you can distinguish anything from anything. But it's a fundamentally different way of approaching the analysis because it was the one that was later made more specific in Employment Division versus Smith and was definitely overridden by RFRA.
Yes, it's applying a different legal test than RFRA commands the court to apply.
So, counsel, under your view, the statute, what would you say would happen in this situation? You have government land and you have two religious groups, and both of them claim that particular land is sacred to them, and that letting anyone but their religious group on this land forever profanes it and destroys their ability to practice their religion. So in that kind of a circumstance where two groups are saying that, what should the government do?
Yes. This is a very common occurrence in prison where two groups want access to the same meeting room at the same time. One wants to exclude the other. And I think you can handle it the same way. If the argument is just having another entity there desecrates the site or is a sacrilege, then you're in Bowen versus Roy land. You know, this is offensive to me or it robs the spirit. But if it's a matter of access, if one group can't be there when the other is there, or just like in a prison meeting room, if you're a Sunni Muslim and you can't have Christians or Jews invading your Juma service, the prison system can ration access to the meeting room based on different times and different needs. And the same way here,
government property would be required to do that.
Quite possibly. there are cases holding that the government is required to do that on government property in prison, in the prison context. And I think the same logic would apply here. It would depend very much, though, on the nature of the access desired and required and what the government was doing.
That analysis would occur at the compelling interest stage, wouldn't it? That's not really a question about what's a substantial burden.
It could be very much easily handled at the strict scrutiny stage. You can imagine it coming up at the substantial burden stage as well. If the plaintiffs are saying
the substantial burden stage? The substantial burden stage is the tribe or whoever it is says, this is how it's burdening my religion. And the other one says, this is how it's burdening my religion. And fine, that's how. And then you decide whether it's a substantial burden. Then you go on. I mean, that's not the end of the story.
That's correct. And there was actually a Tenth Circuit case. The name escapes me, but it was two different tribes had a disagreement over taking eagles. Not Yellow Bear. Two different tribes had a dispute over taking eagles off a reservation. One tribe said, we need to take the eagles. The other tribe said, you can't take the eagle. And the Tenth Circuit resolved it. I think it was on strict scrutiny grounds. So you can certainly take that path. And
Mr. Goodrich, if we agree with you that substantial burden is not a term of art, how should we define substantial burden?
This court has already defined substantial burden in the ARLUPA, the parallel ARLUPA, religious land use institutionalized persons context in the San Jose Christian College case as a significantly great onus or restriction on religious exercise, adopting the plain meaning. That would work perfectly well here. And then Judge Berzon, I think, in her dissenting opinion, applied it to this context, saying if the government controls a necessary religious resource, it controls access to a necessary religious resource, and it completely bars access or destroys the resource, that counts as a substantial burden.
Can I ask about this? Are there any RFRA or ARLUPA cases that address religious use on government property? Because I couldn't really find any.
Comanche Nation is an example.
Where did that come from?
That came from Oklahoma, Federal District Court in Oklahoma. The Comanches, in their religious practice, they stood in a specific spot and centered themselves on Medicine Bluffs. And the Army proposed building a warehouse on the exact spot
The warehouse was enjoined?
Yes. The court issued a preliminary injunction saying that was an obvious substantial burden, physically obstructing their ability to access the site where they carried out their religious practice. And then the government couldn't satisfy strict scrutiny. That case was 15 years ago in the Tenth Circuit. No other district court or Tenth Circuit opinion has gone the other way. And you have a test run of 15 years of precedent in the Tenth Circuit.
The nation went the other way.
Not in the Tenth Circuit, though. You have 15 years, and the government hasn't pointed to a single case.
Okay, they didn't go up to the Tenth Circuit. The government didn't take that one up.
The
federal government.
The government decided it could get by building the warehouse elsewhere and didn't need to challenge that.
Can I ask you about Section 3003? You characterized it in your briefs as a land exchange mandate. That's how it's also characterized in the complaint. And that seems to be the centerpiece of what it requires. But if RFRA applies, it seems, and you're asking for the land exchange to be barred, the very thing that the whole purpose of 3003 is, why isn't that a sufficient conflict to trigger Marcello's sort of get around of express reference requirements that Congress is not subject to magic words requirements?
Sure. A couple points on that. So RFRA expressly contemplates this situation and provides that it applies to later enacted statutes unless the later enacted law exempts itself from RFRA's application by expressly mentioning RFRA. And nobody argues that Section 3003 does that here.
Right. So, that's true of the APA in Marcello, too. And yet the court found that it was overridden.
But so we're all in agreement that RFRA's text would say it applies to 3003. So the only way that you can get around the application of RFRA's text would be to say that sort of an express reference provision is unconstitutional and unenforceable. And that would go against 30 years of precedent under RFRA. No court has ever done that. It would specifically go against the Supreme Court.
Has the issue ever arisen?
Yes, the Supreme Court in Hobby Lobby and Little Sisters of the Poor, two cases, expressly applied RFRA to a later enacted law and expressly cited and relied on RFRA's express reference provision. It could have said, oh, the Affordable Care Act, that's not a clear conflict, they're reconcilable, so we're going to apply it. That's not what it said. It said, there is an express reference provision. The Affordable Care Act did not expressly reference RFRA, so we must apply RFRA to a later enacted statute.
I'm trying the government to have made this argument in its briefs before the panel. There's a little footnote that sort of says something in passing, but is there a waiver problem here as to this argument as an independent argument? I mean, it comes up in context, but as an independent argument, is there a waiver problem?
There was no mention of this argument anywhere in the government's brief except a footnote at the panel stage. And then they tried to expand on it at the rehearing stage. So I think it is waived, but it's also just meritless for the fact that the Supreme Court, you know, you would be going in the teeth of two Supreme Court decisions citing and applying the express reference provision to strike that down. And there's not any reason to do so. This is not a provision that binds successor Congresses, like you need a 75% vote or something like that. All Congress needs to do, if it wants...
effectively turn 3003 into a nullity. Lots of words on the page, and it basically goes away.
Not at all. You can read them together as Section 3003 saying, you know, transfer this land subject to RFRA, and if you can't satisfy strict scrutiny under RFRA, you got to follow RFRA. So you can apply the two statutes together. It's just that Congress understood that this would be subject to analysis under RFRA. And it's not like Congress can't, you know, enact that law. They have considered multiple statutes that would expressly exempt the statute from RFRA. The Equality Act is just one example. So it's not even a case where it truly binds the hands of Congress.
The government incursion here is quite extreme. Suppose the incursion was less extreme, and so instead certain plants there that are deemed sacred are cut down. Would that be a substantial burden under RFRA under your reading of it?
The answer would be likely, and I'd point out that this is the phenomenon you raise is not unique to this case or our position. It occurs in prison cases all the time. It occurs in our LUPA land use cases all the time, where the government may restrict some religious practices, like in Holt, they restricted the growing of a beard, but they didn't restrict the wearing of a kufi cap or praying, like partial restrictions. In our LUPA land use cases, there's often a case where the government denies a conditional use permit to expand your church building, and you can only get 25% or 50% of what you asked for, not 100%. And in all those cases, courts engage in the same type of two-step analysis. One, you identify the religious exercise, what is it, and then you identify in what way the government has restricted to that, and is it substantial?
What does the word substantial and the substantial burden do? And we have all this. I've been wondering about this because there's all this law that says that you don't really make judgments about how important the religious exercise is, because that's up to the person. So how would a court find a burden not substantial, if it is a burden?
Sure. One example would be a truly de minimis fine. So take the Hobby Lobby case as an example. This is where our clients objected to including certain forms of health and...
But in this context, for example, in the land use context, if there was, would you say that the Navajo Nation one was a insubstantial burden? Could we have said that?
Not necessarily.
There was some, concern about the snow, but they could still go there, they could still do whatever they wanted, and so on.
Right. Perhaps one of the plaintiffs there objected, even if the government allowed pure water to be used as snow, maybe that would be insubstantial. But an example here would be, say the government said, look, we're having a lot of use at Oak Flat. We need to have an application process just so we know who's going to go there and when and make sure there's no conflicts. So file an application before you.
Why would pure snow be insubstantial?
Sorry?
Why would, if I genuinely believe that if you put pure snow on top of the mountain, I'm going to go to hell, why is that an insubstantial burden?
I wouldn't
let science decide.
We're
going to let science decide, because I'm pretty sure the view was that putting this wastewater snow on the mountain was actually, I know a little bit about this because I actually did a project to do this back in the construction days in Montana, and the idea was that you actually had treated the water, but obviously the Native Americans thought differently, right? They thought you're basically pooping all over their mountain, right? And so
you know, are we going to say, well, yeah, you may think that, but it's not really happening, so it's not a substantial burden. I'm trying to figure out, and the reason I'm asking this is because you make a, I was really surprised you make a big deal out of the fact that, you know, the physical destruction going on here. But how does that, like, if you actually think having your name printed on a Social Security card is going to send you to hell, that's a substantial burden, right? Like, I'm surprised that you would try to say it has to do with how much physical destruction or how much it physically affects. It doesn't seem to me you'd make that argument in other cases.
Oh, Bowen versus Roy is a good example of the Social Security card where the plaintiff said, if the government uses a number for my daughter, that will rob my daughter's spirit. And this court in Navajo Nation...
substantial burden?
Not in Bowen versus Roy.
No, of course it's a substantial burden. Yes, the thing is, it's just not the kind of burden that under Bowen Roy is cognizable under the First Amendment. So that gets me to, like, would you agree that not all burdens are cognizable under RFRA?
Yes.
Right. So, like, if you own a piece of land and I own a piece of land beside each other, and God tells me I need to build my church on your land, then that's a substantial burden. I'm going to go to hell if I don't build my church on your land. But it's not the kind of substantial burden that's cognizable under RFRA. Would you agree?
I agree that
because
case
of private action.
I agree
what if you're the government now and you own that land, and God tells me that I need to build my church on your land? Is your view that that would be a substantial burden because the government owns the land and the government refuses to sell it? That's all. They're just refusing to sell me the land.
I don't think there would be a substantial burden there. And the reason is...
You would say that it was a compelling interest. It's a very hard problem because the substantial burden question, as Judge Nelson says, runs into this problem of self-definition of religious interest. And I'm not sure it's the right rubric for making these decisions.
I'd love to help you out with that. So the Hobby Lobby example, the plaintiff said, if we include these drugs in our health insurance plan, that will make us complicit in abortion and violate our religion. And the government said, no, that's, you know, it's too attenuated. And the Supreme Court said, we can't dig into that religious theory of complicity. That's your religious belief. That's a religious question. We have to take that as a given. But the burden was not the complicity. The burden was the fine. The multi-million-dollar fines that they faced, that's an objective burden that a court can assess and weigh and determine if it's substantial, if you go to jail or if there's physical punishment.
That's exactly the rule that Yoder put forward, right?
Yoder did mention subjective objective.
Yoder is mentioned in RFRA.
Yes.
But it is not mentioned in RLUIPA.
That's not in the text, correct?
Thank you very much.
So if you... draw that distinction between identifying the religious exercise, which can be subjective or a purely religious question, you know, you rob my spirit or something like that. RFRA calls on you as a court to assess, is a burden substantial or not? There has to be something that a court can assess. If it's a fine, that would count. If it's a physical restraint, if the government actually arrested the plaintiffs and wouldn't allow them to go on Oak Flat, physical restraint is an objective burden you can assess. And then fencing it off and swallowing in a crater so you can never go there again, that is something objective that you can assess as well.
Because I think what you're saying is that if it's a purely spiritual, you know, what you call subjective, it doesn't count, but like it has to have some physical component. It seems to me that's discriminating between religions that are, say, like Native Americans have a more land-based religion, it's more tied to physical, tangible things versus some religion that's tied, it's not physical or tangible. It seems to me like that's a really odd distinction to draw between saying something's only substantial, only counts as a substantial burden if it has some physical coercive component. Does it make more sense to say we already know that there are certain burdens that are cognizable under RFRA and certain that aren't, right? Some certain aren't. And that RFRA was meant to deal with certain kind of burdens where the government is sort of coercing some sort of activity. You know, in other words, when the government doesn't come in and force me to give my land to you, we don't really deem that to be the government. Sure, maybe the government, you could characterize that as a burden. The government's not willing to help you out with your religion, but it's not a burden they're imposing on you.
Right, and I think with that, so there's two things we're circling around here. One is whether the burden is something a court can objectively measure or whether it would require a court to answer a religious question. That's Bowen versus Roy. The second thing we're circling around.
You're saying that when the court can't measure a religious burden, it doesn't count as a burden? I thought we just took the folks' word for it.
Correct. You take their word for what their religious exercise is. But when the statute instructs you to assess whether the burden on that is substantial or not, there has to be some objective burden that you can measure.
When it seems super substantial, you say you're going to go to hell if you put our name on your card. Now, is that the kind of burden that is actually covered by either the First Amendment in Bowen or you know, under RFRA? And you'd say, no, that's just not the kind of burden that's covered. It's very substantial. I'm sorry, you're going to hell. But, like, it's not the kind of, I mean, because seriously, there are people who might say something, you know, there could be burdens that could be very substantial but aren't covered.
That's Bowen versus Roy. This will rob
my spirit. Is Bowen a substantial burden case, actually? I mean, was Bowen about, it isn't a burden, or again, was it another of the line of cases that culminated in Employment Division versus Smith that said neutral rules are not, don't count?
You're correct. It didn't use the term substantial burden, and it was part of that line of cases. If I can get to the second thing we're circling around, which is the term burden is a relative term. It's the idea that the government is making you worse off in some way than you were before. And in order to make that assessment, you have to have a baseline from which to judge whether there's a burden. For example, if I'm Orthodox Jewish and I say, my religion requires me to consume a kosher diet, I want you, the government, to give me money or give me a kosher diet so I can observe my religious practice. And the government says, no, is that a substantial burden? No. The government has not made you any worse off than you were before. It's just maintained the status quo. Yes.
And the reason is because of the background of coercion in religious cases. But they don't have to do it when a Jewish person goes up to the, you know, who's not in prison.
Yes.
So why isn't that, you know, so why doesn't that cut against your attempt to try to pull in all these RLUIPA cases? Because it's one thing to say people that are in prison, the government has to actually facilitate their religion, right? That makes sense. They have to give them a kosher meal. But they don't have to give people who aren't in prison a kosher meal.
Correct.
So why do they have to give them a piece of land?
They don't have to give them a piece of land, but the baseline here, you need to figure out what the baseline is from which you're judging the burden, right? You could take the original baseline of this was Apache land and the government took it by force, set that aside for a minute. The current baseline, as we sit here today, the Apaches have a right to go onto Oak Flat to access it and use it for their religious purposes. They've enjoyed that right by long custom. It is protected by executive order and statute.
So would you draw a distinction between if somebody says, well, we've been worshiping in this government, you know, in the mall on weekends, we've been worshiping, so we sort of have it. They can get like a vested right. But if I'm somebody who has a genuine religious need to worship on the mall in D.C., right, but I haven't done it yet, you would distinguish between those two things? I don't see where that's in the language of, like, a new, you're basically discriminating in favor of established religions with established practices against new religions.
Well, I thought you just agreed with me on the kosher diet in prison, right? There is a baseline that it wouldn't be a burden if I say, government, give me money to have a kosher diet.
Turns away from you, and I actually feed you in prison, right? So I
right.
So
there's
feed you, but that's not true on the mall.
Well, you still, no matter what the case, you have to assess what the baseline is from which you're judging the burden. So the mall case, you could deal with it on strict scrutiny, as Judge Berzon has said, but you could also deal with it by the textual word burden, that it's a relative term, and you must judge whether the government has made you worse off in some respect.
Judge on the word made. So it's not substantial burden, but has the government made you? So is the count, when the government basically just does its own thing, and you happen to be instantly affected, is the government actually imposing on you, or are they making you worse off, or are you just worse off because you didn't get a kosher meal? Did the government, by not giving you a kosher meal, make you worse off, or are you just worse off because you didn't get a kosher meal, period, right, when you're not in prison?
Yes, I would like to reserve 2 minutes for rebuttal, but I think we may be in vehement agreement, because here the government has made the Apaches worse off as they sit here today. They have a right to go onto Oak Flat to access it and use it for their religious purposes.
This is a case about a transfer. I mean, if they kept the land and the government itself, you know, blew it up and made it impossible to access, that would be one thing. But it's the government's land, but they're going to give it over to somebody else, so it's no longer the government's land. That makes it a more difficult case, it seems to me, in terms of talking about both baselines and burdens. What about that?
Well, the government has said that if the government takes away a vested property right, that counts as a substantial burden. That's why we've pointed out that
not
we have.
Right.
Is there
who's
a vested property right here?
Who's vested?
There's a use right.
Well, I wondered about that. I mean, you've made a separate argument that this is being held in trust. If we don't adopt that argument, that it's held in trust, is there some low? You think there's still some other vested right other than just the trust relationship that we could distinguish this case from the myriad of other cases that could be brought in this context?
Yes, Your Honor. And I don't think you have to rely on that, but there is a use right that's protected by Executive Order 13007 and FLIPMA, and the government is taking that away when it transfers the land. If it transferred the land subject to a use right, to an easement, and preserved access forever, that would be a different case. Here, the only purpose is destruction, and that is a substantial burden. I'd like to reserve.
If we agree with you, I'll give you extra time for rebuttal. If we agree that the destruction of Oak Flat is a substantial burden under RFRA, should we remand to the district court to determine whether there's a compelling interest and to decide the remaining winter factors, or do we make that determination? I'd like to get your position.
Sure. I give a different answer on the compelling interest and the winter's factors. So we're here on a preliminary injunction. It's been fully briefed. The government has made no argument on the compelling interest side of the statute. And so it is waived that for purposes of preliminary injunction. We go to summary judgment, permanent injunction, and may have an opportunity to make that argument on remand. But here on the preliminary injunction, no argument, that's waived. We have established a likelihood of success on the merits. The Winters factors, Judge Berzon in her dissent mentioned the district court didn't address those factors, but they have been fully and exhaustively briefed by the parties here, and it's a very easy question, and we would urge the court to decide that here and instruct the district court to grant a preliminary injunction.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Before you step aside, let me ask Judge Gould, do you have any questions for Mr. Goodrich?
Yes, I guess I would ask Mr. Goodrich if there's a treaty right here under the 1890 treaty that bars the land exchange.
Yes, Your Honor. We have argued that the 1852 treaty made a promise to the Apaches to legislate for their prosperity and well-being on their territory, that this is undisputedly originally Apache land, and that destroying it violates the terms of that treaty. But also the treaty would fill in where the government concedes that even a quasi-property right counts as taking that away counts as a substantial burden. We have at least that here. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, Stephanie Barclay from the Notre Dame Law School of Religious Liberty Clinic, representing AMICI, the National Congress of American Indians, and Apache Tribal Elder and other Native American cultural rights organizations. Today, I'd like to briefly discuss three arguments. First, this court should revisit its troubling rule under Navajo Nation. Second, the land rider did not displace RFRA. And third, it is government rather than private action in this case that imposes the substantial burden on the religious exercise of the Apache people. Turning to the first argument, we agree with the test set out from Judge Bumate and that the appellants discussed that would focus on the objective level of government interference with the religious exercise. Now, Judge Van Dyke, some of the questions you were asking about baseline and how we think about that, I think it's also worth considering the perverse incentives and effects that would result if the two-category approach of Navajo Nation really was the universe of claims, even outside of the prison context, elsewhere. That means that in a case like Yoder...
doesn't cover some burdens, right? Yeah, I mean, we know it doesn't cover some burdens. It doesn't
That's
cover
right.
private refusal to transfer private land. So why do we think that it covers when the government is making a choice with to do something with its own land that has an incidental effect? So I'll give you one example and see if I let's say God tells me I need to be buried in Arlington Cemetery in order to go to heaven, right? And that's, let's assume that that's a genuine need of mine, and it's very substantial because I will not go to heaven if I don't get buried there. Then I guess your view would be that then we have to analyze that under compelling interest, that that's subject to strict scrutiny, the government's ability to say, no, we're not going to let you be buried in the cemetery.
if there's a sincere religious belief that the claim must be buried there or else they're going to hell, then you might have to analyze that under the compelling interest test. The government has done so, though, in cases like Comanche Nation in the Tenth Circuit and also Bedini versus Higginson, another case.
So you agree that, I said essentially with the government, that if we adopted your test, that land use decisions of the government would be subject to the review from tens of millions of people.
Land use decisions the government has already conceded are subject to RFRA on page 27.
Decisions like this to alienate property would be subject to the review of millions of people.
Not necessarily, Your Honor, because remember the government can exempt its land use legislation from RFRA. It did not do so here. Now, the government and the mining interests might argue.
That's your example. I mean, there is a baseline problem in the hypothetical, which, as your colleague was saying, I mean, in the hypothetical, this person had no access to Arlington Cemetery. Nobody had access. The general rule was nobody has access unless they are allowed to have access. And here we have a situation where I gather anybody has access, including this group, now, and they're trying to undo that. Isn't that a difference?
The government could, the court could look at the baseline that way as well and say that no one was made worse off. My point is that strict scrutiny is also a way to deal with this, as is exempting government action through this specific reference provision of RFRA. And here, the government could have referenced that explicit reference position. It did not do so. As Judge Sykes recognized in the Seventh Circuit, that doesn't mean that you have a current Congress binding future Congresses. She said that it's simply telling the future Congress how to go about making clear that it's not going to be subject to RFRA. That's in Center for Investigative Reporting.
Wasn't that true in some of the cases that are argued on the other side? That it was a rule about, it was a clear statement rule, not a bar?
The other side, the APA, for example, doesn't have an explicit reference provision that is saying you have to reference RFRA. The Supreme Court has already spoken favorably and relied on that reference provision in two cases. And in addition, there is a strong canon of interpretation against implied repeal. This court and
the APA provision said no subsequent legislation shall be held to supersede or modify the provisions of this act except to the extent that such legislation shall do so expressly, and the INA made no express reference to the APA, and yet was found to displace it on the grounds that it just was simply irreconcilable, and one Congress cannot bind a later Congress to use magic words.
Judge Sykes said that it's not binding a future Congress to just say you're referencing RFRA, and again, the Supreme Court has relied on that provision positively. But even if we set that provision,
is the land exchange here irreconcilable? Because the land exchange seemed to me said you have to go in and consider the religious beliefs of the Indians. Why wouldn't we interpret that as consistent with RFRA, and we basically adopt RFRA through that exception that was?
I think you're right, Judge Nelson, and this goes to something Judge Collins was talking about. They are not irreconcilable, and in fact,
the claim here is the transfer must not occur. It's not that the transfer should occur in a different way. The transfer must not occur, and that is the one thing that 3003 decrees shall occur.
But the transfer could occur if government satisfied strict scrutiny, and it hasn't even made an attempt to satisfy strict scrutiny here, but that shows that these statutes are not irreconcilable.
This goes back to my original question, though. Why are we deciding it on the transfer? Why don't we allow the transfer to happen? And I think I know the answer now that I'm asking the question. And then look at the conditions. I mean, I guess the response is because at that point it's in private hands, and then RFRA wouldn't apply. So we have to address this all up front.
And in addition, page 314 of the final environmental impact statement says that immediately upon the land transfer, public access is cut off. And access was something that existed in Navajo Nation and in Ling, and this would cut that off.
Why don't we just strike that provision? Why don't we allow the land transfer to happen? I'm just trying to figure out how we can. I mean, this is a pretty broad injunction that's being requested.
Well, I mean, the lower court can still receive evidence about exactly the scope of the injunction, Your Honor. This court doesn't have to decide that now. This court has to decide what is going to be the test for the substantial burden analysis. The Federal Environmental Impact Statement also makes clear that this transfer is being done with the eye towards the destruction, but exactly the type of destruction that didn't happen in Navajo Nation.
We don't even know if that's going to happen. doctors. Like, they're going to do a study. I mean, 10 years from now, they may come back and say, this isn't going to work. Or, I mean, I do have some questions that we'll get on this. I mean, could this be restricted so that only half of this land is destroyed and not all of it?
Yeah, Your Honor, I see that my time is up. Would you like me to answer your question? So it is possible that if a land transfer was done in a way where the private party is being instructed and will guarantee that access will continue and that religious exercise will be able to move forward, you can imagine a land transfer like that, that hypothetically, that would impose a substantial burden if that's what the government is requiring. That's not what's going on here under the current government action and under the environmental impact statement that is envisioning the land transfer with an eye to the destruction that will make the religious exercise impossible. Thank you.
Judge Gould, do you have any questions for counsel?
Well, similar to my question earlier, what I want to know is whether apart from RFRA, a treaty right could support the requested injunction.
I think that the treaty rights and the government's trust obligation here are relevant and could also support an injunction, Your Honor. Thank you, Your Honors.
May it please the Court, I'm Joan Pepin on behalf of the Forest Service. As this Court is aware, this case is not about an agency action. It's about an act of Congress in which Congress considered the competing demands on a piece of property, balanced those interests, and made a decision. It decided that Apache Leap shall be preserved for Native uses, for religious and cultural uses, and it decided that Oak Flat shall be transferred to Resolution Copper so that the third largest copper ore deposit in the world can be mined.
Is that transfer conditioned or tied into the uses for the copper mine? And it allows the copper mine, but suppose Resolution Mine took this land and then said, you know, we're not going to have a copper mine at all. We're going to build a resort.
I don't believe it requires them to actually operate the mine. There are still many developmental steps that could happen after the transfer occurs. And if they were to decide that it's not feasible to mine this, then they don't have the land. They would own the land. I would also add, though.
And it would be restricted.
Well, it depends on what you mean by restricted, but the statute requires them, as a condition of conveyance of the federal land, Resolution Copper shall agree to provide access to the surface of the Oak Flat Campground to members of the public, including Indian tribes, to the maximum extent practicable, consistent with health and safety requirements until such time as operation of the mine.
You're saying that it does preserve some access.
Yes, absolutely. Until safety no longer allows it, and if they don't build the mine.
Until the mountain is gone.
Until safety no longer allows it, so that would happen first, right?
Well, they mine it, and then it's gone.
Right.
Okay.
The access will end before subsidence occurs, because it wouldn't be safe to have people accessing the land when it could subside.
Okay. The statute required, this is an unusual FEIS, because you talk about all the cultural and religious things, and I take it that's not a NEPA requirement, that's a statutory requirement here.
EIS is usually talking about those things as well,
that.
Yeah.
But the statute also says you have to accommodate the religion, but it's very vague on what that, I mean, you would say the government has fulfilled that obligation. Well, actually, you probably haven't said anything because you haven't done a new FEIS. Is that accurate?
Right, and I should address your question before about what's the status of that. As we've informed the court in the past, the prediction is for that EIS to be ready this spring.
Shocker, you didn't get it done, though, when you said a few months, 2 years ago.
These things generally take a long time. The prediction still is that it will be ready this spring. We are under an obligation.
There's no sense that they're waiting for a decision from us.
No, that is not correct. There is a 60-day requirement. We have to give 60 days notice of the issuance, and then the transfer must occur within 60 days of the issuance. So the actual issuance of the EIS, you know, we'd said spring, it could be shading over into early summer by the time that 60-day notice is given, but it is coming out in the near future, and so I do believe this case is justiciable. So since this is an act of Congress in which Congress has directed what must happen with this land, RFRA doesn't give this court the tools to nullify that statutory command.
Can I ask a question? So
I'm assuming that either way you read, you know, the statutory provision says it, at the very end, the last one is that you shall transfer the land.
Uh-huh.
But before that, it does require a lot of other things, the environmental review, coordinating with the tribes, trying to accommodate. But you don't, I'm assuming you don't read those earlier things as making it so that you wouldn't transfer land. You need to do all of those things in a way that would also allow you to do the last thing. Is that how the government has interpreted this?
Right. The statute is called the Southeast Arizona Land Exchange and Conservation Act. Its purpose is to, and I'm reading, to authorize, direct, facilitate, and expedite the exchange of land between Resolution Copper and the United States. So that is what the statute is about. There are some conditions, and those are set forth in the statute. But the statute requires the land transfer. Without the land transfer, the statute is nullified. And that is why it cannot be reconciled with plaintiff's interpretation of RFRA.
What do you respond to the question that Judge Berzon asked your friend about the government's waiver?
Well, we did brief this. I admit it wasn't a footnote, although it was a fairly long and substantial footnote, so we would raise it.
Long and substantial. It was rather short and curt.
Spanty pages. But more to the point, Your Honor, the panel was bound by this court's decision in Navajo Nation, which is directly controlling. Once the court asked for briefing on whether it should be taken in bank, we expanded on that argument in that supplemental briefing that the court requested, because, of course,
yes, but
this
if
in-bank
there was
court
a fundamental difference here. I say this as someone who was on the panel. It's somewhat blindsiding to have the whole discussion being about the question of substantial burden, and all of a sudden, you know, in the petition for a hearing opposition, there are pages and pages about the fact that that's really not a question here at all because of a completely different statute, which was and the relationship between them, and a rather complicated set of case law, which seems to run in both directions, frankly, because and some of the case law does seem to support your position. On the other hand, there are two cases involving RFRA itself in which the Supreme Court did apply the language that you're saying is not pertinent here.
Sure.
So it's a complicated question. It wasn't briefed to us. And should we be deciding it now, or at a minimum, should we, after we decide whatever else we decide, send it back to the panel to deal with, because the panel didn't deal with it because it was not front and center at all.
Well, the reason it wasn't front and center is because we didn't think the court needed to reach it, given the binding Navajo Nation decision at that stage of the proceedings. Now that that decision is no longer binding, I do think it is necessary to reach the issue. Whether the court does it in bank or sends it back to the panel for that is obviously an administrative.
Can I ask about Navajo Nation?
Yes.
Would you agree? The panel was, in my view, the panel was bound by Navajo Nation and appropriately applied it. The question is Navajo Nation, can we adopt that same rule here? It seems like that's plainly inconsistent with what the Supreme Court has subsequently said, that our LUPA and RFRA have the same definition of substantial burden. So could we go back and say, now that we're not bound by Navajo Nation, now that we have 15 years of Supreme Court precedent, could we adopt the same rule and say only Sherbert and Verner and Yoder cases are define substantial burden for purposes of RFRA?
Yes, I think that's absolutely substantial with the Supreme Court's subsequent jurisprudence. So
I don't even understand that to be your position, that Sherbert and Yoder are the only two examples. I mean, you have a broader position, which is...
Correct, Your Honor. Our position is that coercion by the government is what is meant by a burden. And so Sherbert illustrates the indirect coercion when you deny an otherwise available benefit because of somebody's religious exercise. And Yoder illustrates direct coercion when somebody was criminally fined for not sending their children to school past the age of 16.
But not prevention.
That's a form of... Well, prevention is a broader word that often is used in cases that involve coercion. For example, in Yellow Bear, the Tenth Circuit case, the word prevention was used, but so was the word flatly prohibit. In that case, the prisoner...
Wouldn't that be happening here? Wouldn't the destruction of Oak flatly prohibit the exercise
no.
of...
No. Prohibit is different. Prohibit is... the exercise of the government's coercive power to punish you or fine you or to do something to the person, not something to the government property. And that is what has marked the difference between a burden and an effect.
That's what Ling sort of, I mean, I think that's where you're going. Ling yes. did say the First Amendment doesn't cover internal use of land. But, and I think the panel addressed that, but RFRA seems to have expanded that. And that's what I'm concerned about, is that RFRA, you know, it doesn't seem bound by these prior First Amendment cases like Ling.
Okay, what RFRA expanded, and the Supreme Court has been really clear on this, and RFRA itself is really clear on this, it expanded the type of government burdens to which strict scrutiny applies. It now applies to ones under a neutral and generally applicable law, whereas under Smith it did not. That is the change that RFRA made. It restored the rule before Smith so that burdens that are imposed by neutral and generally applicable laws still require strict scrutiny. But it didn't change that a burden has to exist.
You think substantial burden it still has. It's unusual because substantial burden is used, and yet all these prior cases, they don't talk about substantial burden. Are we supposed to assume that undue burden that's used previously is the same sure. thing as Congress said?
Yes, and I'd like to give you three reasons why substantial burden means the exact same thing in RFRA as it does under the First Amendment. The first is, of course, in interpreting any statute, the first thing you do is look at the statutory text and interpret it using the canons of statutory instruction. So the statutory text indicates, it uses this word burden. It doesn't say Congress shall not adversely impact. It does not say Congress shall not affect that religious exercise. It takes a somewhat unusual verb, burden, and uses that and indicates no intent to change that. Congress is very clear in RFRA what they are changing. They're changing whether neutral and generally applicable laws require strict scrutiny. But they never suggest that they're changing strict scrutiny, changing the meaning of the word burden. Moreover, it is a well-established canon of statutory construction.
Okay, that, can I back up? Because yeah. I feel like you're... So I agree with you on... I mean, if you're saying strict scrutiny, that's the compelling interest test. And that seems to me to be where RFRA says we're going to look to Yoder and we're going to look to Sherbert. But then it says, and also cannot impose a significant burden on religion. And it's that and. It's unusual that doesn't tie itself to prior case law.
But it does. Both Yoder and Sherbert use the word burden. Now, I admit they didn't use substantial burden,
that be significant? That they don't use... I mean, when Congress uses significant, aren't we bound to look at whether, you know, significant has a different meaning? Why didn't they use the language that the Supreme Court cases use?
Well, you know, I think it's very important to look at Hobby Lobby and Holt versus Hobbs, in both of which the Supreme Court described Sherbert and Yoder as imposing a substantial burden test.
You're right.
So they obviously thought it meant the same thing.
But yeah. Judge Nelson's saying, I mean, that this sentence here specifically does not rely on Sherbert and Yoder. It says, and to guarantee the application in all cases where free exercise of religion is substantially burdened. So there are two things it's saying. One is to restore the compelling interest test as set forth in Sherbert and Yoder. And secondly, to guarantee its application of compelling interest test in all cases where free exercise of religion is substantially burdened. So the substantial burden is not tied to Sherbert and Wisconsin. Now, you can make a separate argument that it's somehow implicitly tied to the prior case law, but it's certainly not tied directly in the statutory language to Sherbert and Yoder.
That is a part of RFRA that didn't change from the previous law. The change from Smith was making the compelling interest test applicable to burdens, an unchanged term from the prior case law, that are generated by neutral and generally applicable laws. Smith said, if the law is neutral, you don't have to apply strict scrutiny. And RFRA said, yes, you do. But it didn't change that there has to be a burden of the nature that the Supreme Court had previously recognized.
The statute now says that any substantial burden triggers strict scrutiny. And maybe that's a change from the prior case law because there's a lot of language in Ling which doesn't apply strict scrutiny. scrutiny that seems to acknowledge that the burden is pretty substantial because, you know, the court at one point describes it that they will assume that it will, building the road will virtually destroy the Indians' ability to practice their religion. And so maybe it is a change in the law from laying it. It's just not a codification of everything that went before Smith.
No, you know, I don't know to what extent the court is willing to look at legislative history, but if you are, there's the legislative history of RFRA is explicit that they were not overturning Bowen and Lange, and that's cited in the briefs. I would also point the court to Professor Douglas Laycock's article interpreting the Religious Freedom Restoration Act, written 1 year after it was enacted in 1994. He was one of the principal experts Congress relied upon, and he said that the rule in Bowen and Lange that the government does not prohibit the free exercise of religion unless it regulates or penalizes a religious practice is generally unaffected by RFRA.
Do you agree? I think a colleague just said it, you know, under RFRA it covers all substantial burdens, but do you agree that it covers all substantial burdens?
That's going to depend what you mean by the word burden. The way Your Honor was using it earlier to include effect, then no, it doesn't include all substantial effects.
As the law says, the substantial burdens imposed by laws or government should not substantially burden. That's what RFRA says. And so it seems to me like in some ways all this focus on substantial burden sort of loses sight of the fact that something can be a very substantial burden, Bowen versus Roy, right? And it doesn't actually count as the type of burden. And we know that has to be true because, you know, the government does not have to give me $10,000, I assume, to get around, you know, that's the other side of it. They don't have to give me $10,000 to build my church if I have no other means of doing it and it's really important to me. That would be a substantial burden if the government's not giving me $10,000, but it's not a burden being posed by the government, right? Would be the way. So that, why isn't that the better way to look at this? Is this the kind of burden imposed by the government to be covered by RFRA?
Well, you could look at it that way, but if you look at it any other way,
it opens you up to the, how can this not be a substantial burden? You're making a whole mountain disappear.
Because of what this court correctly held in Navajo Nation, which is completely consistent with all subsequent Supreme Court case law, which is that burden is a term of art.
You're not actually defending what that we decided in Navajo Nation, as I understand it. You're recasting it so that it isn't simply the two particular kinds of burdens that were in Yoder and Sherpa, but a sort of broader and more abstract concept.
If there are other forms of coercion,
right,
then I do think
that Navajo which said completely, specifically, only what was in Yoder and Sherpa and only penalties. And
this is where we have a disagreement with the other side in the interpretation of the what does it mean when the court said any burden short of that. We think other forms of coercion, government coercive actions. In an oral argument, we discussed eminent domain, for example. If we exercise eminent domain, we take somebody's property from them without their consent. That is the exercise of government coercion against a person's property, and we would concede that that would be a substantial burden. And I do think Navajo Nation leaves room for that in that discussion. But it does not mean that if the effect is big. The effect was huge in Lange. It was catastrophic in Lange and in Navajo Nation.
Was Lange a substantial burden?
Yes, the court did use the word burden, actually. Those respondents contend that the burden on their religious practices is heavy enough to violate the Free Exercise Clause. And moreover, the court...
That's what they said, but doesn't the Employment Department... If you look back at Employment Department versus Smith as to what it actually says about Lange, what it says about Lange is that it was essentially an application of the neutral rule test that applied, which was... made more specific in Smith.
Well, one of the many criticisms of Smith is that it does not very accurately deal with prior precedent. And if that's what it said about Lange, then I think it mischaracterized it.
Supreme Court precedent now.
Sure, but
considered undoing it.
The Supreme Court has continued to cite Lange and to apply Lange for the different principle. Now, I'm quoting you directly from Lange. It is not just about neutrality. It says the use of the land. Is like the use of Social Security number in Roy, because in both cases, the challenged government action would interfere significantly. So there is that effect. would interfere significantly with private persons' ability to pursue their religious beliefs. But in neither case would the affected individuals be coerced by the government's action into violating their religious beliefs, nor would the government action penalize religious activities by denying an otherwise available benefit. That is the same standard as the Navajo Nation.
Do you agree, is it your position that the phrase substantial burden has a different meaning in RFRA than it has in RILUPA?
No, we think across all three fields of religious liberty law, RLUIPA, RFRA, and the First Amendment, substantial burden means the two-pronged test that this court said in Navajo Nation.
But that can't be squared with what we did in Navajo Nation, because we've clearly, in the Ninth Circuit, we've clearly defined RFRA and RLUIPA as having different standards. And that's the problem that I have. Uh-huh. So help me out here. I think that RLUIPA, and I think you just answered it, but if I believe that RLUIPA and RFRA impose the same standards, how does the government win here? If we jettison the Navajo Nation test,
sure.
Give me your best argument for why the government still wins under an RLUIPA substantial burden analysis.
Okay, because in RLUIPA cases, first of all, I would also add that when RLUIPA was enacted, the legislative history of that one explicitly states that they didn't define substantial burden on purpose because they wanted courts to look to prior case law.
It should be defined differently. I'm confused.
No. I think they. I think across all three sources of religious liberty rights, a burden means the thing the government is doing to the plaintiff, not to its own land or not to. In its internal processes with, applying a Social Security number to somebody's.
I agree, that's what Ling said.
Right, and that's what burden means in every single case, with the single exception of the unpublished district court case in the 10th Circuit Comanche Nation that the plaintiff
decided. Yes, you think it was wrongly decided.
We do, and moreover, Professor Barclay's article recognizes that it describes it as the only case that got it right, unlike Lang and Navajo Nation and every other presidential case out there. That's their opinion that that's right and the Supreme Court is wrong.
Are there any other examples where government property is being used? The example that was brought up in, I believe it was Gene Scherer's amicus brief, was the A-roofs, the Jewish A-roofs, where they set boundaries for Shabbat. Have there been any? I was looking for cases on that, and I couldn't find any. Have there been cases on that you're aware of?
The only case I'm aware of is the Tenafly one, and that was a case of, when you don't enforce it against everybody. There was evidence, inconsistent enforcement, and so that's the principle in that case.
I have a question based on a statement that I think you made, and I'd like to have you clear it up if you could. Is the government's position that the term substantially burdened in RFRA has the same content and meaning as it has in RLUIPA and in other in Smith? Because I noticed that there are two phrases in RFRA, in A1 and B5, that specifically mention prior federal cases and Yoder and Sherbert, and those references do not exist in RLUIPA. Is the government's position that substantial burden means the same thing, has the same content in RLUIPA as it does in RFRA?
The case law has gone in two different directions because of the very narrow set of circumstances in which RLUIPA cases can be brought. It's only two circumstances. So you either have to be an incarcerated person, in which case the government controls everything about your life, and if you can't exercise your religion, this is a long way of saying there's almost always a burden present if you're a prisoner, because if you can't exercise your religion, it's because the government has locked you up and you can't go do it.
But their argument is that we need to analogize that in the same way here, that and I'm not sure whether it carries a day or not, but I want to hear your response, that the Indians, that the Apache tribe here is in some ways beholden to the government for access to their religious practice. So why isn't that similar to the prison context?
It's different because in the prison context and in the RLUIPA land use category, the coercion is directed at the person or at the religious organization that owns property that, due to zoning rules, they're not allowed to use the way they see fit.
The statute doesn't say substantially burden the person. It says substantially burden the person's exercise.
Well, it also says application of the burden to the person. And moreover, in Hobby Lobby, the Supreme Court emphasized the word person a lot in RFRA. It has always been, there is no case where this has not been the case, where it is the burden that the person imposes on the plaintiff. The restriction on their liberty or their use of their property is the burden under all three sources of religious liberty law.
On a different subject, the one that Judge Gould has been asking about the treaty, I gather that your position is that the treaty is essentially non-enforceable against the government.
This particular treaty is just a peace treaty. It doesn't settle any rights to land. It doesn't create any land rights.
I'm wondering is whether if we thought that the treaty had any relevance here, given yesterday's argument in the Supreme Court in another Navajo Nation case about the enforceability of fiduciary rights against the government, would we have to wait for that case?
No, the principles in this case are so well settled that they can't be affected by the decision in that case. There's just black letter law that treaty, that trust rights have to be express rights. There has to be express rights creating language in a statute or in a treaty.
But
and this
that issue in the case that was argued yesterday, i.e., I guess in that case the government's sort of agreeing that there were fiduciary rights, but it says they're unenforceable.
Well, all I can say is that to apply a different principle in this case would be revolutionary. Treaty language like this that just says it doesn't convey any rights, it doesn't take the land into trust, it doesn't settle boundaries, it's just a peace treaty. It doesn't create the specific rights-creating or enforceable language that...
Counsel, it's Judge Gould, if I could ask you a question on that point. I thought a clause in the treaty called on the government to pass and execute laws that are conducive to the happiness and prosperity of the tribe. If that's true, doesn't destroying their sacred mountain or trading it away go against that?
Your Honor, very general language like that has been held by the Supreme Court in, I believe, another Navajo Nation case, to not create enforceable rights. So, no, that cannot be used to create a right here. And I'd like to just point out that neither does that treaty create any use of fructuary rights, and neither does Executive Order 13007. Executive Order 13007 requires that agencies, to the extent practicable and permitted by law, preserve sacred sites. I'm skipping over a lot of caveats, but two things about that. One, the order explicitly states that it is intended to improve the internal management of the executive branch and is not intended to, nor does it create any right, benefit, or trust responsibility, substantive or procedural, enforceable at law by any party against the United States. So it can't create a usufructory right, and neither does this treaty. Now, this court has
helped. What about something short of the treaty? I think you're probably right that there's not a trust relationship here, but they do seem to be in a different situation than the general public as to this land. Is there any sort of differentiation that we should give to that in determining whether RFRA has been violated?
No, RFRA doesn't give this court or any court the power to decide categories of people that are entitled to more than what RFRA provides. Congress could take that history into account. And in fact, at the time that RFRA was enacted, there was another piece of legislation being considered that would have addressed other issues with Native American religious exercise and the First Amendment. Unfortunately, that legislation never became law, but RFRA, only Congress can provide that relief, and RFRA doesn't give this court the power to make distinctions between Native Americans and other people when it comes to the use of government resources.
So now, Judge Gould again, on my concern about the treaty here, you said that there was Supreme Court precedent saying that the general language about passing laws conducive to happiness and prosperity of the tribe was not enforceable under some Supreme Court precedent, but you did not give us any citation or mention a case name. So could you please provide citations to the clerk of the court, unless you're prepared to mention them now?
I do know that they are cited in our brief, but I'd be happy to put the citations in a letter if the court wishes. I'm afraid I cannot just recite them now. If I may make just one...
I just have a question. I'm sorry. I'm just going to back up because I just want to understand. Is it your view that we have to define substantial burden to resolve this case?
The court would not need to address that issue if it were to decide that the Southeast Arizona Land Exchange Act overrides RFRA, even if they were in conflict, because as the Supreme Court held in Dorsey, and this, it was a 5-4 decision, but the justices were 9-0 on this point, including four justices that were in the majority in Hobby Lobby, that there is no magic password. An earlier statute saying there must be an express reference cannot prohibit or stop a later Congress from repealing it by plain import or implication as it chooses.
What did you do with the two Supreme Court cases?
Sure, I'm happy to get a chance to address those. In Bostock, it was... Okay. The other one, then, is Hobby Lobby. There's a footnote where the dissent had urged that Congress had considered, or I think the Senate had considered, an amendment, and then that would have provided the relief that was argued for in court, but didn't enact it. And so it was making an inference from that unenacted provision that Congress didn't intend to provide exceptions. And when the Supreme Court cited this provision of RFRA for the proposition that unenacted legislative history was not enough to override that presumption in RFRA, RFRA generally requires exemptions from subsequent laws. That's what RFRA does. Generally applicable and neutral laws.
But it certainly was premised on the notion that the statute was pertinent as to the clear statement rule, was it not?
Yes, but it can't amount to a holding. It would be the elephant and mouse holes canon, I think, would prevent the court from saying that this footnote represents a reversal of the Supreme Court's 9-0, well, 5-4, but everybody agreeing on the principal decision in Dorsey.
Application to a particular statute on the ground that
it's right. And in this case, on their interpretation of RFRA, the Southeast Arizona Land Exchange Act is irreconcilable with their interpretation of RFRA, and so the court has to decide, well, did Congress, in enacting this land exchange statute...
Why is it irreconcilable?
Well, there's a not on our theory.
Oh, okay. I thought you were saying... I thought you were saying... You don't think it's irreconcilable?
No, because we think that burden is a term of art brought forward from previous case law, and it requires that the government be doing something to the plaintiff and not doing
something. That, and we do need to reach this question, is it irreconcilable? Because, I mean, the statute, the land exchange statute, specifically says you have to take consideration of the religious rights, and so why wouldn't we interpret that and say that means this is not irreconcilable with RFRA, and that exception actually should be read consistent and embodied RFRA.
I think the fact that the statute clearly did consider religious uses of the lands cuts the other way. It shows that Congress was aware of this. They held hearings over years because this legislation came before the Congress for several years before it was ultimately enacted. And they held hearings and they were aware of the competing demands for this piece of property. And they provided for those religious and cultural uses to be taken into account by setting aside Apache Leap, by requiring as a condition of the exchange for Resolution Copper to surrender its rights to mine under Apache Leap. But they also provided that Oak Flat must be transferred. And with respect to that,
some religious accommodation even within Oak Flat. Am I not? I thought there were a whole bunch of plants that were transferred and things like that.
Yes. But what it doesn't give the Forest Service the power to do is not to transfer it. After the consultation, the Forest Service is supposed to negotiate with Resolution Copper for mutually agreeable ways to...
Forest Service, before it transfers it, say, you know what, you can only mine on half of this. I don't even know if that's technically feasible to do, but could the Forest Service actually do that?
Given the number of times this statute says, as a condition of the transfer, The fact that it doesn't say so.
The statute contemplates them being able to mine the entire.
I mean, not Apache Leap, but yes.
Right. Yeah. But, I mean, of this area, which, I mean, it's like a 95% overlay with what they claim are, you know, their religious.
With the current, yeah. I mean, in the earlier hearings, other areas were also recognized as sacred. But the focus of this litigation is Oak Flat. Okay. And yes.
I heard you just, in the course of your answer, change the answer from where you had started. I thought you had said that, in response to the Chief Judge's question, that you wouldn't, we wouldn't need to reach the meaning of substantial burden if we held that under a Dorsey-type theory that there was a conflict and it overrode. But then I thought you changed the answer to say you can only find the conflict if you find that it would be a substantial burden.
I guess what I meant to say, Your Honor,
it's built into the question.
I think what I meant to say is the courts could say, even assuming that it would be a conflict with RFRA, a conflict with RFRA cannot stop this land exchange from going forward because it is commanded by a subsequent statute, and under binding Supreme Court precedent, the later and more specific statute controls.
You're out of time. I am. I'll let you make a concluding statement. We took you over time.
Thank you very much. The last point I would just like to make is Professor Barclay has suggested that this wouldn't be a big deal because other environmental laws already subject the government's land use actions to judicial review, which is undoubtedly true. But in those cases, when a person says the use of this land, the government's use of this land, interferes with my recreational, spiritual, and aesthetic enjoyment of this property, that gets them standing. They still need to prove that the government has violated NEPA or NIFMA or FLIPMA or any of the other Clean Water Act, any other statute. But the plaintiffs, the position they're arguing for here would be that anybody who can say this area impacts my religious exercise, not the term burden that the statute used, which has a history and a meaning and brings the roots of the old soil with it, but the but just any effect on my religious exercise would go straight to strict scrutiny for every government land action, whether or not, because RFRA doesn't limit strict scrutiny to actions that are central to a religion, to actions that are compelled, as long as there's an impact. So you could have the scenarios that you described, Your Honor, where somebody says, I don't see how you can distinguish. If somebody says, I need to build a church on this land or I'll go to hell, that is effectively the rule that they're arguing for here. The government would have to at least satisfy strict scrutiny on that. And that is a very, very broad rule that they're asking for here.
Public land or private land?
I'm sorry?
Is land being public land or private land?
Either. But they admitted that they can't do that with public land. And for the same reason, a right to use government land as an individual sees fit has never been recognized as, the Supreme Court called it a veto, just like this court did in Navajo Nation. It's never been recognized that a person's religious liberty rights include the right to tell the government what it may or may not do with its property, especially in this case where what the government is doing is transferring it. It's the disposal of property which Congress has unfettered power under the Constitution to do. Well, it would be an agency action. I mean, it depends. If it was like this case where Congress dictated exactly how it has to go.
At the burden issue.
No, that would not be a difference. I mean, well, some of the things that are going to happen later are not government action, right? And so that's a difference.
But it wouldn't be just, you're saying it's just transfer, but if it wasn't just transfer, if the government was actually doing the act that was going to eliminate the site for the purposes of the religion, would that make a difference as a substantial burden?
Well, that was the case in Ling, and the Supreme Court held that actions that do not coerce the plaintiff are not the kind of actions that fall within the protection.
Okay. All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Good morning, and may it please the Court. David DeBald on behalf of a group of private sector amici. Plaintiff's proposed rule here would erect huge and insurmountable obstacles to the sale or exchange of government land to private parties, and that's a power that Congress has under Article 4's Property Clause, which the Supreme Court has repeatedly said is without limitations. The damage to private enterprise would be profound if a purchaser of federal property could only use that property later as if it were the federal government. And that is the rule that is being argued for here, although not in so many words.
Well, I wanted
to... It wouldn't matter whether it were the federal government. I mean, according to the federal government could do the same thing anyway with regard to the mine.
Our position is that under Ling, that even if the government itself were to take action to restrict access to its own land, it would not implicate either RFRA or the First Amendment. But the case is even easier when the government is making a decision to sell its land outright. In the Establishment Clause context, also under the First Amendment, several justices in courts have recognized that the solution to a First Amendment problem is for the government to sell or give away land where some alleged constitutional violation is based. And this is certainly no different. The government would be giving a fair value exchange, its property to a private entity. That private entity is going to take years of further analysis and development to decide whether it even goes forward with the mine, and if so, whether that mine will impact such things as the Oak Flat campground.
Is it possible that the mine ultimately would not cover that entire area?
Yes. In fact, let me back up. Over the course of the pre-legislation and then post-legislation process, the amount of land that will be impacted by this copper mine has reduced significantly, and to the point where in the materials that are included with the FEIS, the one that was withdrawn, it points out that the subsidence may, in fact, never even affect the campground. And I don't bring this up to say that we have to argue this case on different facts. I bring it up to emphasize the point that we are talking about putting a restriction on what the federal government can do based on private action, non-state action, that may occur, in this case, years later.
If that's true, it actually sort of cuts the other way on the Dorsey argument, because that says, well, maybe there's a way to do this that you could tailor it, and so maybe there isn't a direct conflict between the transfer and RFRA, and so maybe RFRA says you need to pick the way that preserves this.
You know, the points I'm making are about whether it's feasible for the mining company to actually do the mining and to what extent it does it after it becomes its own private property.
Why wouldn't the mining company just say, we'll preserve the campground? Wouldn't that resolve this litigation and you'd get 90% of what you want?
Well, I don't think it would resolve the litigation because...
They'd say we want more than the campground.
Right, and they've said that in their brief. They've said this is not just about the campground.
What have you done already? There was this requirement to accommodate religion.
Yes.
Can you address that? Because sure. Lean did rely on some of the actions that were being taken to accommodate religion. And so I'd like to know what's being done here.
Sure. The reference you make to Ling, the court said, although the government has the power to do what it wants with its own land, it should be solicitous to the interests of Native Americans.
But by the way, is that a binding? I mean, it's an odd statement in Ling because it's like, even if Ling were destroying it, I'm not sure that it would have come out differently. It's almost like they said that in a way to sort of make themselves feel better about the rule that they were adopting. Unfortunately, we are in the position where if we rule for the government, we have to feel really bad about what we're doing because there's a possibility this is completely destroyed.
Well, so you asked about what things have been done. Even before the act was enacted, there were a number of compromises made to reduce the size of the acreage that would be affected. It went down by nearly 1,000 acres. After the act went into effect and during the EIS process, Resolution agreed to forego about a half a billion tons of a total of almost 2 billion tons of ore that will not be accessed during the mining process in order to reduce the footprint of the subsidence. There were also
specifically to accommodate the religious beliefs.
To carry out what the statute requires, which is for the secretary to work with both sides, try to come up with mutually agreeable solutions. By the way, that's an area where the statute gives discretion to the secretary to take certain actions. And as we pointed out before, when he gets to the end of that process, he has no discretion. That's the conflict.
That's when the new FEIS comes out.
Right. When the new FEIS comes out, 60 days later, the land has to be exchanged.
We're being asked to decide this, whether to approve the land exchange, and we don't even know what the final proposal is. What if the new FEIS said, hey, we're going to reduce the footprint by 50%?
I don't know that it would change what the plaintiffs are arguing, or the plaintiff is arguing here, but, you know, because they've sought an injunction to stop the land exchange no matter what. That's what they sought. They filed their lawsuit.
And I think that's very problematic. I mean, I got to be honest. I'm more interested in what these conditions are, and I don't feel like I have enough before me to decide this. Because if the mining company came in and said, well, that's nice, you know, we're not going to do any of that, and the government still approved it, I think that's a different case, potentially, than if, you know, the mining company comes in and says, hey, we're really going to accommodate within reason what we can do here.
I agree it's a different case in terms of a different set of facts, but I think it reinforces the point I made a minute ago, which is that what we're talking about is deciding whether or not the government can take an action, a binary action, either keep the land or sell it, based on our predictions, our fears, our wondering about how a private party will eventually use that land years and years from now.
But the FEIS at least is about how the land's going to be used, right?
Yes.
It's not just about the transfer.
There are a number of permits and approvals that are required even after the land transfer, and the statute specifically says in order to guide the agencies who will have to make those decisions about permits, because some of this activity will still go across or affect land that will remain in the federal government's hands. For all those reasons, Congress wanted a single EIS prepared in advance of the land exchange so that there would be, better visibility into what the effects might be, and number two, to help guide what those future decisions would be. And as I said, it helped in the process by reducing the impact. It also caused, most significantly, a new alternative to be proposed by the Forest Service that will require the tailings, the waste from the mine process, to be transported in a different manner to avoid affecting other areas of this larger piece of land.
How did the condition reduce the impact? As my understanding is, the impact is still that the whole area is going to disappear.
First of all, the subsidence, which will occur gradually over a course of 30 years, will have a smaller footprint as a result of the accommodations that were made, both pre-enactment and post-enactment.
But the smaller footprint, does the smaller footprint eliminate any of the area that the Apaches are claiming, say is their sacred area?
Well, part of the problem is you have to have the land exchange occur before the company can finish up its exploratory efforts before it even starts building the mine. And as part of those efforts, and this is in the withdrawn FEIS materials, the company had already made decisions to reduce the amount of ore.
Is that reflected at page 21 of Apache's brief? There's a map. Is that still the map that we should be looking at for purposes of determining what the impact would be?
As a general matter, but the size of that circle
includes the concessions that were already made.
Well, the size of the circle you're looking at is the entirety of the Oak Flat withdrawal area. And what I'm saying is we won't know until after the exchange occurs and after further exploration is done how much of that area will actually be affected by the subsidence. I'm not here telling you that there won't be significant subsidence. I don't want it to be misunderstood. My point is
does any of that matter? Because do the conditions include a right of access to the Apache, even if there's land for them to access?
Yes, it includes a right for them to access after the exchange to the campground area,
after the mine is built.
Even after the mine is built, there is a potential for them to still have access. There's a mitigation plan related to the subsidence that acknowledges that there is a possibility that even the campground will be spared. But if it's not, even that is going to be literally decades away as the process of building this mine takes shape after the land exchange. And I get into all these details again to emphasize that what you're being asked to do is to consider a rule by which the government's decision whether to sell land is going to depend on whether some private action, potentially years down the road, will do something that if the private actor were the government, it couldn't do. And that is not how the law operates, and I haven't seen any.
Well, but this is a new. I'm with you, except for the fact that Congress stepped in here and actually defined how this was supposed to be done, and that the accommodations were supposed to be made. But that's different than if the government just went out and sold this on the open market. But
that doesn't turn into state action. We cite a number of cases in our brief at pages 12 to 16 about how significant government involvement and approval of and even complete funding of a project does not turn it into state action. And that's what we're dealing with here. This is a significant threat to the line between private action and state action if you follow through on the logic of what the plaintiff is asking you to do here. So I think I'm out of time.
Yes.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you very much. Mr. Goodrich, I'll give you 3 minutes.
Thank you, Your Honor. When we started this case, the government swore up and down there are only two categories of government action that could ever qualify as a substantial burden: imposition of penalties or denial of benefits. By my count, we now have at least 4 exceptions to that rule. One is coercion in prison. The government admits that that's a substantial burden, even if it doesn't fit the two categories. The autopsy cases counts as a substantial burden under the quasi-property rights theory. The destruction of personal property counts. And the eminent domain destruction of real property rights counts. We're now up to a 6-category theory from the government.
The category that is missing is use of government property. And we've got the Comanche case. That's where we're struggling.
Yes.
Because you can add up all these different categories, but I'm not sure the category you need is encompassed there.
Yes, it's gerrymandered to exclude one particular category.
Well, I think that's a little bit of an overstatement. It's not gerrymandered. If it is, it's gerrymandered by the Supreme Court.
We would disagree, Your Honor. The analogy to prison, prison is government property. It's internal government affairs. And the Supreme Court has recognized when the government manages that property in a way that prevents religious exercise, that's a substantial burden. The government tries to rationalize all this by lumping it under the category of coercion, or specifically coercion of the person. RFRA doesn't say coercion. It doesn't say prohibit. It says substantially burden. And it doesn't say burden the person. It says substantially burden a person's religious exercise. But even if you take coercion as a necessary requisite for a substantial burden, what is coercion? The government hasn't defined it, but it's the use of government power to stop you from doing something you want to do or to make you do something you don't want to do. And here we have coercion in spades. Right now, the plaintiffs can go on to Oak Flat, access it, and use it for their religious purposes. If they were fined for doing that, the government would agree that's a substantial burden. If they were physically restrained from doing that, just arrested and handcuffed and stopped from going there, the government admits that would be a substantial burden. Here it's worse.
That is the baseline. How does that drive the analysis? Because it must. If, for example, this was government property, but it was not open to the public, you wouldn't have the same argument, right? What if this was, the Pentagon building or something, and there was some tribe that had the center of the Pentagon building as its sacred spot? Presumably, you wouldn't make the same argument, would you?
Correct.
Because everybody's ever had access.
That would fail both on substantial burden and on strict scrutiny.
Now why? Therefore, the prior access has to be all important, and on what theory is it all important?
It doesn't necessarily have to be all important, but I do think the term burden is a relative term. It requires some sort of comparison to what went before, and sometimes the status quo ante is a proper baseline. But here the baseline question is easy. Whether you go back to the time when they were forced off the land or you just look at it right now, the baseline is they can go on to Oak Flat and access it, and that's being taken away, and that's a substantial burden. I think the core of the government's argument is not really textual and not really precedential. It's really a policy argument. It's about we, the government, need to be free to do what we want with our own land.
I didn't know you're over, but the Supreme Court said, it's not like they're making that up. The Supreme Court said that in Ling. They said those very words. And the question, I think, that I got to grapple with is, does RFRA change that Ling analysis?
Yes, and I would love just 1 minute to speak to that.
You might only get 10 seconds.
Okay, well, that policy argument that if we apply strict scrutiny to across the entire range of government operations or even just government's own land, that will unleash chaos. That is precisely the argument made in Employment Division versus Smith for rejecting the burden-shifting framework, and that is precisely the policy argument that Congress rejected in enacting RFRA. And it told courts, don't be scared of strict scrutiny. It's a workable test for striking sensible balances. We have 30 years of experience applying that test. It has proven workable, and it's a test the government hasn't even tried to satisfy here. So the district court should be reversed.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We went over time, but this is very important issues that we're trying to resolve here, and I appreciate the extra effort that everybody put in to this case and to these matters. Mr. Goodrich, Ms. Barclay, or Hall Barclay, Ms. Pepin, and Mr. Diebold, thank you very much for your presentations here today. The case of Apache Stronghold versus United States of America is now submitted. Thank you. We'll be adjourned.
All rise. Session stands adjourned.